Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 5th of July. Governor Deval Patrick will be joining us shortly. He has written a totally absorbing and important book, A Reason to Believe, Lessons from an Improbable Life. He is the governor of Massachusetts. As you know, he is the first African-American to be elected governor of Massachusetts, and he is the first African-American in history to be elected, reelected governor. He has a very interesting background. He grew up in Chicago's north side, south side, rather, a tough, poor background. Father was gone, lived with his grandmother and grandfather and mother and sister. Not a lot of emotion there. He found many teachers who expressed great interest in his mind, and he was interested in furthering himself. So he went to, got a scholarship for an elite prep school in New England. He worked for Texaco and for Coca-Cola. He got a fellowship and was able to travel through Africa for quite some time. And I think that was a formative experience. But he's been able to straddle all these different worlds, poor worlds, segregated worlds, worlds that he learned to navigate and found he was able to succeed. And, you know, it wasn't always easy to do that. His book is very poetic in many ways, and he tries to tell people how important it is to get rid of their cynicism. He worked as an attorney for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He was appointed by President Clinton as the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. He began his second term of as governor of Massachusetts in the year 2010, and he joins us now. Governor Deval Patrick, hi.
Kathleen, how are you? I'm sorry to be a few minutes late.
It's all right. I just talked about you. I said what the book was about, how great you are. So you missed all of that. But
thank you. Well, yeah. Maybe I should hang up and not mess it up.
I just read for parts of the book, which I did read, and I just found totally absorbing. There's a theme that seems to run through it, Governor, and you talk about being touched by simple kindness of strangers, which happened in many parts of your life, didn't it? There were people who had nothing who took you in, people you didn't know who took you in, people who realized that you wanted to learn and helped you out. There were a lot of strangers who were very kind to you, and you in turn have been kind to a lot of people.
Well, I'm just trying to pass it on, and that's very much what this book is about. I am, Kathleen, an unrepentant idealist. Hmm. And I think I have come to see optimism and idealism as strength. And the book, as much as anything, is a gesture of thanks to the people who have given me that sense of optimism, the teachers who helped me, who gave me a reason to believe in a broader world I could live in, the parents and other adults who gave me a reason to believe in the importance of a moral rudder, and that you could make decisions that might put in jeopardy your short-term ambitions, but feel better and actually achieve more in the long run. You know, voters who've given me a reason to believe in the power of grassroots politicking. And I think what I'm trying to do is to offer an understanding to others that it's within the power of any of us to offer that same kind of transformative kindness and hope to others.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing. You really teach us also that we need to take a lot of risks in our lives, because you put yourself in places that were completely foreign to you. I mean, completely foreign to you, and you were able to survive and thrive.
Well, the more you do it, of course, is the more the stronger you are, the more confidence you have in your ability to do it. But, you know, it has, I think, something to do with growing up on the south side of Chicago, you know, most of that time on welfare. We had a community that was in so many ways broken. The schools were broken. The sidewalks were broken. The playgrounds were were broken. Lots of families were broken. But it was also a time when every child was under the jurisdiction of every adult on the block. So if you messed up down the street in front of Ms. Jones, she would straighten you out as if you were hers and then call home, right? So you get it two times. And I think what those adults were trying to get across to us is that they had a stake in us, and that being a member of a community is understanding the stake that each of us has in each other, in others' dreams and struggles as well as our own. And I think when you begin, as I have had the blessing to do, to see my community in broader terms, beyond the neighborhood, beyond the expectations the limited expectations maybe that folks might once have had, and see yourself as a member of a national or even international community, it has had, for me, some real implications about the choices I make.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your family, because your father left. He was a musician, and there's also a reconciliation aspect to the book. Somebody told you to save a place for him right. in your life, which you did, and that worked out. But he really wasn't there for you for much of your life. Your grandma and grandpa were fairly reserved people. Your mom wasn't terribly demonstrative, but she did some extraordinary things, like coming to visit you when you were in Africa.
Right.
But you didn't have this family that was... were supporting you, Duvall, were with you all the way. They just weren't there. They were poor. They had stuff to do. It was the larger community that had to look out for you as well.
Well, and my family was a part of that. My father, my relationship with my father was complicated, as many sons' relationships with their fathers are. My father and mother split when I was four. He was a very gifted and dedicated jazz musician, spent most of his career with the Sun Ra Orchestra, which is an avant-garde orchestra, and they spent most of their time in New York and overseas, so I didn't see him a lot when I was a kid. And my mother was, as you read, somewhat emotionally detached, I think ultimately quite sad and depressed, although she lived with us for the first 20-some-odd years of our wedding, of our marriage, Diane and me, and helped raise our kids. My grandparents were very sort of Victorian folks, very reserved, high expectations, but not very communicative. And one great blessing for me is that I got a lot of that affection and demonstrative love from teachers and from, the old ladies in hats at church. And in other settings, and they helped fill a gap for me, I think, emotionally.
Well, they recognized that you were really a good kid.
They did. I mean, my family did recognize I was a good kid too. And to their great credit, never, for example, never having had any experience in school beyond, in my mother's case, the 11th grade, in my grandparents' case, I think it was the third grade, not once did they pour cold water on my ambitions to go to college. And, what I first wanted to be was an architect. That's the very first thing I ever remember wanting to be. I still want to be an architect one day.
You can do it. And, believe me, if anybody can do it, you can do it.
I think I can. And, nobody in my family ever said, that's beyond your reach. They just said, you got to work hard and focus. And dedicate yourself, and anything is possible.
I want to talk about this transition, which I can't imagine because I have a hard time imagining what it's like to have an incredible amount of money and a very privileged life. But you come from the south side of Chicago. Things are pretty rough in your neighborhood. They're pretty rough in your life. It's hard for your family. And all of a sudden, because of your academic skill and people helping you out, you go to Milton Academy in Massachusetts, where people sometimes have drivers, and they're very wealthy, and you're black to boot, so you got all this completely different world that you're able to navigate, and I still don't understand how you were able to do that.
It was, again, great adults who reached out and who cared about me. I mean, going to Milton Academy from the south side of Chicago in 1970, and seeing it for the first time the night before classes began, and coming all on my own, was like for me landing on a different planet.
I imagine.
It was just, they had a, I write about how they had a dress code in those days, Kathleen, and the boys were required to wear jackets and ties to classes. So when the clothing list arrived at home, my grandparents splurged on a brand new jacket for me to wear to class, but a jacket on the south side of Chicago in our neighborhood was a windbreaker.
Oh, bless their
so
hearts.
So the first day of class, all the other boys are putting on their blue blazers and their tweed coats and so forth, and I had my windbreaker, and I thought, oh, boy, I've got to crack the code. I've got a whole lot to learn. But again, there were great teachers and other adults, parents of other kids, who reached out, who helped me understand what this new language was, what this environment was, and my family at home, though they couldn't quite absorb what I was experiencing, and even when I tried to describe it to them, for them, they were encouraging because they just thought I was out of harm's way back on the south side of Chicago. So in many ways, you felt like you were straddling these two worlds. The price of admission to any one was rejecting the other. Over time, I came to see that as a false choice.
Was it hard for you? I know your dad was very interested in black issues and criticized you, I think, at one point for becoming too much of a white guy because you were going to this fancy school. Did you have difficulty straddling this white and black world in terms of language, in terms of being able to talk to anybody fully about what your life was and who you were?
Well, that's really what I was getting at. My father was very disapproving of Milton Academy because he thought it would make me white, as he used to say. Nobody among my pals at home on the South Side could quite absorb what I was trying to describe to them. Back at Milton, they seem most, and I'm generalizing in all of these cases, of course, but they seem mostly interested in how quickly and how thoroughly I was assimilating, not in really understanding where I had come from. And I think for a while, you know, a lot of folks in those days would say that that experiences like this were about giving you a great education at the risk of a broken heart, that it was just that emotionally demanding to try to straddle these different worlds. And I think what helped me in the end was understanding that I had to figure out who I was all on my own, independent of what environment I was, but what were my own values, my own likes and dislikes, my own inner core, my inner rudder, if you will, and to be that and be true to that all the time, no matter what setting I was in. And as I came to understand that, and Kathleen, candidly, it took me years, I mean, past my time at Milton, to come to that conclusion, but as I did, it was the thing that enabled me to be comfortable in all kinds of unfamiliar settings, including, you know, the time in Africa or, you know, sitting in the White House with the President of the United States.
Right. Isn't it amazing when you think about it? I don't know if you've reread your book lately, but when you look about where you started and where you are, you just say, isn't that something?
Well, you know, mine is a very American story in many, many ways. It doesn't get told as often as we'd like in this country, but it gets told more often in this country than any other place on earth. And mm-hmm. In many ways, one of the reasons why I wanted to get into public life at this stage in my own life and thinking about the contributions I can make is because I'm concerned that the American dream, that American story, is up for grabs, and there are things that are those ambitions, those hopes for people to change their own circumstance and that of their family is becoming harder and harder for people to imagine, let alone reach for. And that has some implications, I think, for the choices we make in public policy as well.
You spent, and I think that sometimes travel is transformative for us, not that you didn't have a lot of those transformative experiences before you went to Sudan, but you spent quite some time was it a Rockefeller scholar?
Fellowship, yes.
Fellowship. And found yourself looking at one point in the book, you write, even before my year was over, I knew I had stood in places that I never could have conjured on my own and had received what I had come for, a deeper understanding of how broken, impoverished, or otherwise challenging surroundings could not defeat the resourcefulness and generosity of people. You met some extraordinary people, and you found yourself in a truck that was overturned and people were hurt. You put yourself where people had absolutely nothing, and you didn't exactly know what road you were going to take either, because they didn't know exactly what to do with you at first. I think that was a big experience in your life. Am I right?
It was huge. It was. It may have been the most empowering experience I ever had. For the benefit of listeners who haven't read the book, this is a year traveling fellowship I was awarded as I graduated from college at Harvard, and the requirement of the fellowship was that you spend a year in a distinctly non-Western culture, and they gave you just enough money to get where you're going and to get back so that you could, you know, not so much that you could hole up in the local intercontinental hotel and just wait out your year in comfort. And so I wrote to everybody I knew who knew somebody anywhere on the continent of Africa, because I was fascinated by that part of the world. I'd never traveled outside the United States before. I got one response from one person who worked on a project, a UN project in Sudan, and he said, "I'm not sure what you're going to do, but come and we will figure it out." And so I landed in Cairo in late in the summer after graduating, and I hitchhiked from Cairo to Khartoum. It took about 2 weeks, the last week or so, without a bath. And, you know, I came into Khartoum out of the Nubian desert looking like a piece of the desert I'd just come through and found the office of the person I'd been writing to, only to learn there that he had left the week before for 2 years in Long Beach, California, and had said nothing to his office about my coming. So I had to talk my way onto this project eventually, and they sent me and a Sudanese guy who had just graduated from the University of Khartoum, was about my age, out to the western part of the country, out to the Darfur region, which was a 5-day trip on tracks through the sand. And believe me, if my children tried this today, I'd kill them. But I was months without any contact at all with home, because there were no mail service or phone service. Email didn't exist then, or texting and so forth. But I learned a lot about my own resourcefulness and on a whole bunch of levels, and about the similarity of people, and also the grace of people who in many cases had nothing at all.
Mm-hmm. And you end that particular chapter of the book, and I'm wondering how these experiences relate with your second campaign for governor, when you were invited to meet with Islamic American community and you agreed. You were criticized for doing that. But I think that the experience that you had as a worldly guy and somebody who'd seen a lot by that time in your life made it pretty natural.
Well, we are at a very peculiar time, I think, in our own social and cultural history here in the United States. In the wake of 9/11, of course, I think in so many ways we've been governed by fear, and too many of our fellow citizens have mistaken the evil that was behind the planning of that attack with the teachings of Islam and people who follow the Islamic faith. And so I had an opportunity during the last campaign to come and meet with Massachusetts residents and citizens who were Islamic, who were feeling marginalized and in many respects afraid because of the environment that we're living in. And I will say that in Massachusetts is better than in many places, but we have our failures of understanding here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts as well. And when I went out, I was criticized, as I write about in the book, for for meeting with other members of the community who were also voters and also residents and had many of the same concerns that everybody else did. And I think that I was determined to do that because I am determined not to put people in a box in the same way I'm determined not to be put in a box.
Right. No, it's hard to put you in a box, sir. That's for sure. We're speaking this part of our program with Governor Deval Patrick. He is the governor of Massachusetts. He has written a book I highly recommend. His life is quite extraordinary, and the message that he has to give. It's a good book for young people, for people of all ages, but it cuts right through the cynicism that we have about so many things. And as he so eloquently described, it's a story of how he was able to really get at his inner core so he can function and inspire people just about everywhere. The book is A Reason to Believe, Lessons from an Improbable Life. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can send an email if you'd like. That's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Governor Deval Patrick, our guest. The book is A Reason to Believe, Lessons from an Improbable Life. And we go to phone calls for you. Let's go to Tom in Burlington. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I want to make just a couple of real quick points. In your 2010 campaign, you had a wonderful ad campaign, and my sister Mary was in it. In the last frame, you're shaking hands with this elderly woman. Well, she's 65, and her name is Mary Baldwin Boyle Doherty. I don't know if...
gracious.
And anyway, that's my sister Mary. And it was a fabulous thing. She has this wonderful look on her face, and you had captured so much excitement of the campaign. And we had our senator lost. His name was Feingold, Russ Feingold. Mm-hmm. And his ad that he the last thing you saw of him, he kind of walked off alone on stage right, and it was a really weak campaign ad compared to your campaign. But I'd like to point out, my father was from Chicago. He was a congressman.
Is that right?
And he passed the first civil rights bill in America in 1957. It allowed blacks to apply for federal jobs and get in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very difficult for him to put it through. And it was from 1865 to 1957 we finally got a bill through the Congress. Mm-hmm. And grew up on the north side of Chicago. And one thing about Chicago that I'd like to say as traveling around, Chicago is a very positive place. That people don't cut people down particularly, as I have found. And another thing is, in the time when you were growing up and I were growing up, we had this black power thing where the blacks were trying to get this identity. And if you spoke like a whitey, you were actually put down and cut down. And you can't go into a classroom and learn how to speak English if you don't, or read English if you don't speak it on the outdoors. And I think the great thing that you have done and President Obama have done, if they've given an example, somebody to look up to, and this whole thing about talking like a black person and talking like a white person, I think that has kind of disappeared.
You were very careful about your campaigns and the kind of campaign that you wrote. And I know you're trying to take on cynicism in the book, and God bless you for it. But running a positive campaign was very important to you.
It was, because I wanted, win or lose, to be able to look myself in the mirror afterwards. And I think one of the reasons why so many people have turned away from politics and from voting, you know, we have this extraordinarily low voter participation for an industrialized Western society, is because people feel so turned off by the nastiness of it.
Yes.
And we had moments in that first campaign when we were getting some traction and the other candidates were starting to take me seriously. Remember, this is the first office I've ever run for. And the negative attacks were just coming fast and furious on the media. And I sat with our advisors, and we got lots and lots of advice, much of it unsolicited, that it was time for us to turn on our negative ads and so forth. And I sat with all of our advisors as they were making the case for what we should do. And I finally said, you know what? We can't do that without breaking faith with all the people we have recruited at the grassroots. Because this was a positive campaign, because it was about asking for the best in everybody and reaching out to every community and doing it at the grassroots. And we stayed away from negative advertising and won significantly, and it happened again this last time around.
Yeah.
I was thinking about, first of all, Tom, thank you, thanks to your sister for participating in the ad. And just if I may, Kathleen, just make a couple of points.
Of course.
First of all, I appreciate compliments about our campaign ads, but I really feel strongly that the real strength of our campaigns was both the first and the second was being active at the grassroots, because nothing substitutes for the respect shown by going to where people are in every sense of the term. Where they live, where they work, where they are economically and socially, where they are in their own heads, and personally inviting them into a sense of having a stake in their own civic and political life. And I think that's why we won, not because the ads were better. I think the ads were are never enough. It's just not enough to, you know, have a campaign that's about raising as much money as possible so you can have a relationship with voters through 30-second ads in the last few weeks of the campaign. But I was thinking about the comment about how one speaks, because I write in the book about coming home on the first vacation from Milton Academy back in 1970, and I'd been away for 2 or 3 months at that point. And my family all greeting me in the front hall of the little apartment where we lived, and my sister saying, "Ooh," she said, he talks like a white boy. And I was devastated. And my grandmother shot back, "He speaks like an educated boy," and saved the day. But I'm very aware of the dynamic that Tom alluded to there.
There's this, I love the scene that you described when you're meeting with Barack Obama. And he's a senator, and you get this idea that you're going to run for governor, which I want you to explain more. And I love this dialogue. And you're talking to him. I'm thinking of running for governor, you tell him. "Are you sure?" he asked. "Yes," I said. "You got any money?" "No." "Got any name recognition?" "No." "You got any staff or consultants yet?" "No." And then you went into how you wanted to help people and the tough calls you wanted to make. And he says, "I'm in. What do you want me to do?" There you are yet again in your life, just putting yourself in the unknown. But you had the vision.
Well, I think the vision, I know the vision that was motivating me was not having the job, but doing the job, in the sense that I feel like having spent most of my professional life in the private sector and in business, there's this tremendous pressure to manage for the next quarter, to get the short-term results, sometimes sacrificing the long-term interests of the enterprise. And I think that behavior has crept into the way we govern, where we govern for the next election cycle or the next news cycle, and we aren't making the kinds of hard decisions today that we know will leave things better, and that we know we have to confront in order to leave things better. That notion of generational responsibility, Kathleen, is an old-fashioned idea. Every single one of us learned it from our grandparents, that we're supposed to do what we can to leave things better for those who come behind us. And so I wanted to see if that vision was winning vision for a candidate, and then whether we could in fact govern that way. And I'm very, very proud that even during the worst economy in living memory, we have invested at the highest level in the history of the Commonwealth in public schools, that we are really motivating this innovation economy. We're concentrating on the on the concentration of brain power we have here in Massachusetts, that we're investing again in roads, rails, and bridges, and broadband expansion, the unglamorous work of government, but it's been neglected for a long time. And as a result of all that, we're growing twice as fast as the national growth rate. Our unemployment rate is well below the national average. We're adding jobs faster than 46 other states, and our state is one of only three with a positive fiscal outlook in the country. So that governing for the long term and making those choices, those tough choices, based on a set of values about generational responsibility is a winning strategy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so important for us to remember. I use that with my son all the time, and I never know if it's effective. Remember what your grandfather did and your grandmother did, and here's how they lived, and this is what the Depression did to them, and their importance in service and in politics and all. I say that over and over again. Sometimes you don't know if anybody's hearing you, though, right?
They're listening. They're listening. They want to make sure you don't think they're listening.
Okay.
But they are listening.
As a father of a couple daughters, I take that. With
marvelous young women, yes.
Yeah, that's great. I thought a very touching part of the book, and you describe in very poetically, you're meeting your wife, and I want you to tell that story, but let's start with more the end of the story. You're very honest with, of course, her permission, Diane's permission, to talk about how incredibly rough campaigns can be and what it did to her and how the public eye in terms of media and lies was just too much for her. And you almost decided you weren't going to do this anymore. It was rough, and you're very honest about it.
It was very rough. I mean, you know, the extraordinary thing is that Diane, who is herself an accomplished lawyer, grew up in New York and has practiced in New York and in Los Angeles and briefly in Washington, now in Boston. She's the real talent in our family, and frankly, when she's out doing her public stuff, she's better at it than I am. But she's a very private person, and she would have preferred, I think, if I had stayed in the private sector, although she knows how important to me it's been to try to contribute in this way as well. And during the campaign, particularly as I was saying earlier, when it got nasty, and all kinds of charges were being hurled, and it's remarkable how many of them reporters seemed to want to either print or pursue without any basis at all, or they did then. And so you were finding yourself having to disprove these negatives. You know this didn't actually happen, and so you have to prove it didn't. And that sort of thing really, really wore on her. When we won, and we won big, and I immediately turned to the business of building this new administration and getting the right people in place and figuring out what the budget consisted of, because we were going to have to file a new one 3 weeks after I was in, I was paying a lot less attention to how hard the campaign had been on Diane personally. And then in the early weeks and months, we just were getting hammered. There was no honeymoon at all because of a couple of missteps. And Diane went into a very serious depression to the point where she ended up in the hospital. And it was a... It was an awful time.
Mm-hmm.
And the the doctor was the doctors were concerned about this being public because of the stigma that's attached to depression. So I was being spirited in and out of the hospital, you know, at night and that sort of thing. And after a couple days, Diane said, "Look, I'm not ashamed. I just don't feel well. And I don't want you sneaking around. Let's just put a statement out." And against the doctor's advice, we did. To the media's great credit, they were marvelously respectful and understanding. But even more than that, the thousands of notes and cards and messages that Diane received that were so encouraging, people saying, you know, your willingness to be public about this and to talk about it, as she has since done helped save my own life. And so she has, she's gotten to a point now in, at 5 years of being a first lady of knowing how to say no and what to say no to, and because she's still very active in her practice. But one of the things that she has spent time on is talking about depression and mental illness, and it's among her most powerful appearances.
Isn't that something that she's been able to help so many people?
She has.
Yeah, and also that you hear the whole courtship story, and she had been married before to a really abusive man who almost probably killed her at one point. It's just, oh, wasn't it wonderful that you two met at that amazing Halloween party? Which you got to tell us about. It's very funny.
Well, we were set up at a Halloween party in Los Angeles where she was practicing and where I was clerking for a federal judge for a year. And the party was apparently arranged so that we would meet in a crowd. She and many of the people at the party knew that. I was clueless. All I was told was that it was a Halloween party. I was relatively new to town. Please come, and I'll get a chance to meet some people. And I have to come in costume, which is not something I do.
No, I can imagine not. I can't see you doing that.
But they insisted, and you know, I didn't want to be a you know, a stuck-up Easterner, I guess. So I came in a caftan I brought back from Nigeria, and I had a spear, and I painted my face up, and no shoes, and I strode into the party, and I was the only one they had invited to come in costume.
Why did they do that?
Oh, I think they thought it was funny. They are still friends of ours, I'm happy to say.
Good.
And
good.
Diane and I have been together almost 30 years, not quite 30 years.
Oh. So here you are, Trey.
Here we are.
And she's dressed, you know, kind of chicly, and here you are, the only guy in a costume,
and
trying
armed.
To be serious.
I mean, for goodness sake.
Oh, brother.
But she was extricating herself from a, as you said, a very bad first marriage.
Yeah.
Really wasn't interested in meeting anyone else, but her best friend is someone I had met who said, look, he's only going to be here for a year before he goes on to another city, and I think you two have a lot in common. You ought to know each other, and I'm awfully glad for that best friend.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Polly in Two Rivers. Hi, Polly.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen and Governor Patrick.
Hi, Polly.
I wanted to share with you, I am a Massachusetts resident of 50 years and a Wisconsinite for 10.
All right.
I miss my Massachusetts roots very much, sometimes more than others.
You still got the accent,
you
Polly.
Sure do, Polly.
Yes, I do. And I will tell you that with the political environment going on in Wisconsin now, I really miss my Massachusetts roots.
Mm.
But that's another story. I wanted to share with you, my mother read your book. I was just back in Massachusetts in May, and I wanted to share with you that my mother, who is a Reagan Republican and has changed her views in the past couple of years, said that if you were a communist, she would vote for you. That's how much she liked your book.
So,
my sister and I, we had a good laugh at that one because I said that's how much impact you had with her from your book, and I thought that that was the highest compliment that she could pay to you.
Wow.
So
wow.
I just wanted to share that with you.
Polly, thank you. Please assure your, tell your mother I appreciate that, but assure her I am not a communist.
Oh, you never know what you're going to get from callers. Thanks, Polly, very much.
That's very
and
fun.
I'm sure that you're getting, because I found the book wonderful too. Your story is just fascinating, and aren't you glad that whoever came up to you and said you got something people will want to read about that you finally said, all right, I'll do it?
It was a long time saying, all right, I'd do it. The agent I've been working with is somebody I met 15 or 16 years ago, and he came up to me after a speech I gave and said, I think you should take the speech you gave and the stories you told in that and turn it into a book. And I said, you know, why? I'm not old enough to write a book. Certainly not a book that's a memoir. And we just became friends, and he kept talking about it and about what kind of book it would be and what kind of space it would fill. I started to organize with the help of a wonderful young man named Jim Hirsch, organize stories into these lessons, and so here it is. It's been quite an experience to first to write it, and then to talk about it. And it's marvelous to have the reaction from Polly's mom
yes,
and so many others.
Yeah, that's a great story. You can tell that one to others. That's a good story.
I should have gotten her address.
Two Rivers, Wisconsin. You could probably find a Polly who speaks like that in Two Rivers, Wisconsin. David in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. Nice program, and good morning to you, Governor Patrick. It's
hi, David.
Honor to speak with you. I note that you and our president have similar stories of success, of what they used to call in America, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, although some people don't have boots yet.
Yeah.
But with one significant difference, and that is that I'm presuming that you grew up in a black culture on the south side of Chicago, whereas our president grew up pretty much in a white culture. And I'm wondering, first question is, what difference that might make in your stories? And the second part of my question, we have two mixed-race grandchildren, adoptive grandchildren, and coincidentally, the father being a troubled black man from the south side of Chicago, mm-hmm. the mother being a equally troubled white woman from Wisconsin, and they're growing up in a white culture. Mm-hmm. They're in middle school now, mm-hmm. Bright kids and so forth, and getting all the love and affection that pretty much that kids get. But I'm wondering if you have any insights into the challenges that they may have when they get out in the world in mixing or in a black culture where they've been raised in a white culture.
Really important questions and provocative ones, David. And I'm not sure I have the answers. I think on the first point, it is. It's true that growing up on the south side of Chicago, the community was overwhelmingly African American. My teachers were African American until the seventh grade, and in fact, you know, we only went downtown. I think maybe once or twice a year, once to go to the Sears for our back to school clothes, which was on State Street in those days. And maybe one other time to go to the movies, but our whole orbit was on the South Side. Now that was until I was 13 or 14 years old, and then I was at Milton Academy for most of the time. And believe me, that is the other end of the spectrum.
Sure is.
South Side of Chicago. So in many respects, I grew up in both those worlds. And as I was saying earlier in the program, David, I am more and more convinced that those differences need not be determinative. Definitive. That is, you know, I took what was a value in terms of the development of my values from each of those worlds and from other worlds I've lived in. And I think the key for me was internalizing those values and not the geography, if you will, and letting the values be what define me in whatever setting I've been in. And I think it's why I feel at ease in a whole bunch of different settings. And I suspect that that's going to be the experience of your grandkids who are, you know, if they are, you talked about them getting the love and encouragement that we wish all our children should get. And I think the other part they should get is information and exposure. Because more and more today, the lines between cultures are blurring. It's happening in music and the arts. It's happening in you know, on television and popular culture and what have you. In many, many ways, not enough, but it's radically further forward than it was when I was in middle school, as your grandkids are today. And that's a good thing. You know, I've spent some time in my life doing civil rights litigation, and I'm a great believer in the importance and the value of integration. But I've always been struck that in many respects we integrated the schools because we sent the kids in to do what the adults wouldn't do. The adults wouldn't integrate the neighborhood. So we sent the kids in to integrate the schools. And still, folks are learning that integration is really about leading integrated lives, not just what we do, you know, in our workplace or what we do in the schools, but how we live our whole lives. And I think the more people learn that and live that, the stronger we are as a country. And I say that recognizing that we are a much more polyglot national community than we have ever been, that there are many, many more differences, and a lot of those lines have been blurred and will be blurred, and that's not a bad thing at all.
No, I agree with you. That is a good thing. More phone calls in a moment. David, thank you very much for your call. Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick is our guest this hour. His life, well worth reading about, is in A Reason to Believe, Lessons from an Improbable Life. 800-486-8655. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Governor Deval Patrick, our guest, Virginia from Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning to you both. Governor, as soon as I began listening to the program this morning and heard who the guest was going to be, I immediately thought of a couple of instances where African Americans have actually pulled themselves out of almost unbelievable circumstances growing up, and became the person that they wanted to be. And one of them was a gentleman from in the 20s and 30s. This is right around the 20s and 30s. He did not know his own father. And this was down in Tennessee. And all of the children, classmates, and the grown-ups, even in his, small neighborhood there, would chide him and would not let their children play with them with him because he was fatherless, as if he had anything to do with not having a father. So he began going to this church. He'd heard that this minister was unbiased and he was kind, and started going to this church, and he'd go there and sit all by himself, and he'd race out before the meetings were over, and because he didn't want anybody to see him or know him. He was only 12 years old, and once he got there, one day he was not able to get through the crowd in the church. And the minister put his hand on that boy's shoulder and turned him around, and he says, son, whose child are you? And you could hear a pin drop in that church. And then a big smile came on that minister's face, and he says, I know whose child you are. You are the child of God. And he said, there is an unmistakable resemblance.
Thank you, Virginia, very much for your call.
What a beautiful comment.
Yeah. Tim in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hi, Tim. How did you find us?
Oh, I listen to you on occasion on the Internet. I absolutely love you guys. And
thanks, Tim.
Definitely.
Thank you, Tim.
I have a couple questions. I heard Governor Patrick on Tavis Smiley, and what it, you know, kind of startled me was he didn't sound like a politician.
Is that good, Tim?
Yes, and I was like, whoa, he got to governor, and he sounded like a politician. So I paid attention to what you had to say. And I'm kind of curious if you've heard of our governor here in Colorado, because he ran for mayor of Denver and then ran for governor of Colorado, and his pledge was to not have negative campaigns, and he has a pretty squeaky clean background. Mm-hmm. Being a non-politician.
Is this Governor Hickenlooper?
Yes. And,
yeah.
When he ran for governor, they turned negative ads on him really hard, and he put up an ad where he went into a shower with his suit on to display his dislike for negative ads, mm-hmm. and just shook himself and said, ooh, like that. And that was his ad.
Yeah, you really don't sound a whole lot like a politician. I mean, you sound the way politicians ought to sound. You're very genuine. This is good.
Well, thank you. I don't know how politicians are supposed to sound. I think, you know, I come to the job humble. I don't think I have a corner on all the best ideas. I am listening hard for for good ideas. I don't think any one party has a quarter on all the best ideas. And I'm, as I say, I'm trying to govern for the long term. That's the difference. You know, not being a career elected official, I think, means I can do this job without thinking about my career. We don't have term limits here in Massachusetts, but after I finish the second term, I'm done. I have a few more things I want to accomplish. I want to make sure that they are institutionalized so that they will last beyond my time in office, and then I'll look forward to getting back into the private sector. But I hope that there are lessons from Governor Hickenlooper's experience, ours here, President Obama's experience in the first campaign in particular, that there is an appetite of voters out there, of citizens out there, who, number one,
we have 5 seconds
to a campaign that's positive.
Yeah, I'm with you. Thank you so much for being with us. It's a wonderful book. We're plumb out of time. We got to go. Thank you. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much, Kathleen. Yeah,
our pleasure to have you on. Deval Patrick, Governor of Massachusetts. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease.